Okay, so this is a talk on inequality. And I want to start the talk by looking at a book written by two UK academics, Professors Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And the book is called The Spirit Level. Later in the talk, I'm going to mention a little bit about a second academic book on inequality, written by a Frenchman, Thomas Piketty, called Capital in the 21st Century. And I'll talk about other issues as well. First of all, The Spirit Level. So this was a book published in 2009, and its full title is The Spirit Level: Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better. And in the book, the professors take data from the United Nations and they focus on the income differentials in rich, developed market democracies. So the main focus of the book is on the richer, more developed market economies. And they measure for a whole range of countries how much richer the top 20% of the population are than the bottom 20% within each country. So within each country they look at the range of income and they ask the question, how much richer are the top 20% of the population compared to the bottom 20% of the population? What they found was that in countries like Japan, Finland, Norway and Sweden, the top 20% of the population are about 3.5 to 4 times richer than the bottom 20%. So in the Nordic countries, Finland, Norway and Sweden and Japan, the top 20% are 3.5 to 4 times richer than the bottom 20%. But in countries like the UK and the USA and Portugal and Singapore, the differences are twice as big. In other words, in countries like the UK and the USA, the top 20% are eight or even nine times richer than the bottom 20%. So there's twice as big an income differential in countries like the UK and the USA compared to Finland, Norway and Sweden. So that's the first thing they found. Very, very clear differences. Then what they did, within each country, they compared the extent of inequality in incomes with key social indicators, such as life expectancy, children's maths and literacy scores, infant mortality rates, murder or homicide rates, the proportion of the population in prison, teenage birth rates, levels of trust, levels of obesity, levels of mental illness, and social mobility. How easy was it to move from a lower to a higher income position, and so on. All calculated using internationally comparable data. So taken together, all of these different social indicators give us a pretty good picture of the overall level of well-being in a society. What did they find? They found that the countries with the greater differences in incomes between the top 20% and the bottom 20% did worse, far worse, on all the social indicators. In other words, the countries with higher levels of difference between the top 20% and the bottom 20% had lower life expectancy, higher infant mortality rates, higher homicide rates, greater proportion of the population in prison, lower levels of trust, and so on. But that's what they found. To test the relationship further, the professors Wilkinson and Pickett then analysed similar data for the 50 states that make up the United States of America. You can get exactly the same data for the 50 states separately in the United States. Again, the evidence was very clear. The more unequal the distribution of income, the worse the performance on all the social indicators. So the greater the level of income inequality, the worse is the performance on all the social indicators. Less trust, higher rates of mental illness, more homicides, more people in prison, less social mobility, higher rates of infant mortality, etc. So the conclusion they came to was very clear. The data showed that for poorer countries, they did some quick looking across at poorer countries, they concluded, there the level of national income and economic growth still matter. In other words, for them, the key thing is how do they raise the overall level of incomes. But in the rich developed world, the overall well-being of a society depends very much on the degree of equality or inequality in incomes in that society. So inequality is very important and is linked clearly to many different social indicators. So basic conclusion is, the more equal is the distribution of income within a country, the greater is the extent of overall well-being in that country. The more unequal is the distribution of income, the lower is the overall well-being in that country. Now that's a statistical overview. Perhaps more poetically, they express the findings in this way. Inequality hollows out the soul. Inequality hollows out the soul. That was a title of an article they wrote more recently for the New York Times. So they used more research, and what they found was that not only is inequality divisive and socially corrosive of community life and of trust, but it also damages the individual psyche. It's a very interesting evidence and argument that they make on this. They point out, because of our evolutionary inheritance, humans know instinctively how to cooperate and to build social ties. But equally, humans also inherit a tendency to competition, to status competitions, and feelings of superiority and inferiority. When you examine evolutionary history, what you find is, if you like, competing factors at work in what determine the evolution of the human species. Within a group, if a group was separate from other groups, within a group, those individuals that were more selfish and less caring for others tended to do better in survival terms than others. But when groups start to compete with other groups, tribes compete with other tribes, what you find is those groups that have the greater number of people who act in a caring and compassionate way, who cooperate with each other, those groups outcompete other groups, the groups with more selfish people in them, in the survival stakes. A group that has more caring and compassionate people, people who look out for each other, will do better in survival terms than a group that has too many selfish people within it. They don't work together. So within an evolutionary sense, if you like, we inherit competing tendencies. Tendencies towards selfishness, tendencies towards caring and compassion. And we know this from what the Buddha said. The Buddha talks about greed, hatred and delusion as being, if you like, the root causes of the human predicament. But he also talks very clearly about how we equally inherit the potential for loving kindness, for generosity and wisdom. So there's competing tendencies there within us. So they reflect upon this. And what they say is that within ordinary human life, we use these strategies. Sometimes we tend towards individualism and selfishness. Sometimes we tend towards cooperation. We use these strategies many times in our lives. Inequality, however, shifts the balance of behaviour and feelings towards envy, status competition, and so on, and helps to drive consumerism. And in this way, status competition helps to create the conditions for psychiatric disorders like narcissism and mania, as well as anxiety and depression. So greater inequality in a country increases the pressure for status competition, for envy and so on, damaging mental health and distorting our personalities in a negative way. And what they found when they looked at the evidence again for the 50 American states was that depression was more common in states that had greater income inequality. So they were linking the incidence of depression with income inequality. In another study they talked about that looked across data from 26 different countries, that study found that schizophrenia was about three times as common in more unequal societies as it was in more equal societies. Schizophrenia was three times more common in more unequal societies as it was in more equal societies. Another piece of research, probably done by Gallup or someone like that, a major opinion poll company, looked at 34,000 people across 31 countries, and they discovered that in countries with bigger income differentials, with greater inequality in income, status anxiety was much more common. And it was much more common not just at the lower levels of the social hierarchy, but was more common at all levels in the social hierarchy. The richer people in a society that is unequal do not escape the suffering caused by inequality. There's increasing amounts of research that shows that the richest people, you know, the 1% or the 0.1% at the top of a society, they're not happy. They're full of envy. They're full of insecurity. They don't think they have enough money. They are caught up in a treadmill of anxiety and envy and suffering. Doesn't make them happier, doesn't make them more fulfilled. So there's a whole variety of statistical indicators there that show the damage that inequality does in terms of indicators of social well-being, indicators of personal mental health. So we'll put that to one side for the moment. They reflect upon how is it that countries that have lower levels of inequality of income achieve those lower levels of inequality of income. And this is quite interesting. In some ways, the classic examples are Japan and Sweden. Because in Sweden, there are huge differences in earnings. Very, very big differences in earnings. A very high degree of inequality in earnings in Sweden. But what they do, of course, is that they have a huge redistributive system of taxation. Very high levels of taxation. They redistribute income massively through taxation. And they provide a very generous set of benefits through their welfare state. So what happens there in Sweden is you start with very high levels of inequality in earnings, and through a system of taxation and welfare state, there's a massive redistribution of earnings that takes place. That's why you end up with a much lower level of inequality. In Japan, they don't have high taxes. They have much lower taxes, a much smaller welfare state. But the spread of earnings is much, much lower. You have nothing like the inequality of earnings in Japan. So what this suggests, they say, is that if you want to attack inequality, you can either attack at the level of pay and earnings and try and narrow that and implement a fairer distribution of pay levels, or you can do it through a redistribution of income through taxation and benefits, or a combination of both. You find examples working in different ways in different parts of the world. In Japan and Sweden, if you like, are the best examples of the two extremes. So you can narrow inequality by working at the level of pay and or by working at the level of taxation and benefits. And if you do that, then you can improve the overall level of well-being in society. When we observe what's been happening, though, in the world in the last 30 years or so, there are some trends that are unmistakable, and they're seemingly very hard to stop. So, for example, at first I didn't believe these statistics, but they're true. In the late 1970s in the United States, this is just an example of the United States, if you were the chief executive officer, the head of a major company or financial institution, you earned about 26 times more than the pay of your average worker. So the top of a company in the United States in the late 1970s earned about 26 times more than their average worker. That was thought to be too high. There was a famous management consultant at the time, a man called Peter Drucker. He thought this was very wrong. He thought the absolute upper limit should be 20 to 1. A few years ago in 2011, if you looked at the pay of chief executive officers in the United States, you find they earn 209 times more than the pay of the average worker. Over 200 times more than the pay of the average worker. So in 30 years, we've gone from 26 times more to 209 times more, an absolutely huge increase in inequality. The UK is not so bad. The ratio is only 130 times more. Which is quite mind-boggling figures, aren't they? 209 times more, 130 times more. And you may be aware of this book that came out, was it last year or the year before, by the Frenchman Thomas Piketty, Capital in the 21st Century, 600 or 900 pages long, about inequality. Quite extraordinary, this book. I think it was the number one bestseller in the United States. A dense book on economics and inequality was the number one bestseller in the United States. It clearly touched a chord, especially after the Occupy movement, we are the 99%, the 1%, and so on. But he argues in his book that the massive recent growth in inequality can be one of the main causes is this fantastic growth in the pay of the heads of major companies and financial institutions. They are grabbing much more of society's income. So how has this come about? It hasn't occurred in a vacuum. How has it happened that we've had such a dramatic increase in the earnings of the heads of companies? And you can loosely link it to the rise of neoliberal economics and capitalism, the coming to power in the late 70s of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and so on. They were, if you like, signals that something was changing. But you can trace it within the discipline of economics. Certain ideas became more prominent in the 1970s. And one of the key figures in this is a man called Milton Friedman, an economist, who in 1970 wrote a very famous article in the New York Times. And he argued that the sole purpose of a company, a firm, or a financial organization, the sole purpose of a company is to make money for its shareholders. He argued that a corporation, a company, should focus totally on making money and should not be concerned for its employees, customers, or society. That was not the corporation's business. The corporation's business was to make money for its shareholders. So he started to push this idea. He was an increasingly influential economist of that time, probably the most influential economist of the second half of the 20th century. And his idea was taken further later in the 1970s by a couple of professors who wrote an article in an academic business journal. And apparently this article is like one of the most widely cited articles, business articles of all time. In other words, very, very influential. And they picked up on Milton Friedman's idea. They said it's right that the sole focus of a company should be on making money for its shareholders. And in order to make sure that the heads of companies did this, they said that the executives running those companies should be turned themselves into major shareholders in those companies. In other words, a large part of their annual pay or compensation should be in the form of shares in the company they worked for. So, in other words, if you were the head of a company, you didn't just receive ordinary pay. A large part of your pay was being given shares in the company that you worked for. And many companies and organisations have been doing this since the 1970s. And what you see now, and again, I mean, some of these statistics are mind-boggling, and they're very difficult to get your head around what they mean. You just have to give them a little bit of time to sink in. Because of this method of compensation, in 2012, the 10 highest paid chief executive officers of companies in the United States each received more than $100 million annual compensation. Now just try and think about that an individual receives for being the head of a company $100 million for your annual compensation. It's just quite extraordinary levels of wealth and income. So I don't just mention this. Sometimes people say, well, all you're doing is stimulating envy when you mention these figures. But actually, there are other reasons why such pay levels are a real problem. You may be aware that a few weeks ago there was an American economist here in the UK visiting, a man called Joseph Stiglitz. He won the Nobel Prize for economics. And he writes this. He talks about why is it a problem that we have these incredibly high pay levels. He says because it's actually destructive of the long-term performance of the economy. Not only does it create more inequality, but we are paying chief executive officers money that could have been invested in the firm. It's also the way they get compensated through stock options, which gets them to focus on the short term of the next quarterly return. So that's a mechanism that enervates and distorts the economy because you don't invest in machines or long-term projects. In other words, it's in the interests of the head of a company in the United States to manipulate the share price upwards through an emphasis on short-term profits in order for themselves to earn more money. That's how they get more money. And the emphasis on the short term means that companies don't think about the long term. They don't have an investment strategy which looks ahead a long time. They become totally focused on the short term. So he says that's another reason why it's bad. But I want to focus on two particular aspects of inequality and the consequences of these aspects. I want to look at trust and I want to look at empathy. At trust and on empathy. So again, Joseph Stiglitz, the American economist. He has argued quite strongly now for a few years that trust is a major casualty of the staggering levels of inequality that we have now. He says that as inequality widens the gap between citizens, so the bonds that hold society together become more fragile. And as the top 1% become ever richer, other people lose faith in the economic system, perceiving that the odds are totally stacked against them, and something vital in our way of life is eroded. What we see is the loss of trust. And we can trace this tendency all the way back to the ideas, if you like, of the first economist, the man who first identified, if you like, the characteristics of capitalism, a man called Adam Smith, writing at the end of the 18th century. And he argued about something called the theory of the invisible hand. And basically this said, if every person looks out just for themselves, then we will have an outcome in which the economy is fully efficient for the benefit of everyone. He argued, if everybody pursues their own self-interest, actually, that will benefit everyone. This is the idea of the invisible hand. And Stiglitz has characterized this in this way. He says, he's talking about how this inspires modern economists, modern capitalists. He says, to the morally uninspired, it's an appealing idea. Selfishness as the ultimate form of selflessness. By being, this is what the people think who are involved in this, by being really selfish, they are being selfless. They are helping all of the economy to grow and they're benefiting everybody. So this is how they justify to themselves sometimes their selfishness. So that what's happening is now, because of this, we have an erosion of trust. And no economy, no democracy can function for very long with such decline in the level of trust. If you think back to 2007, 2008, when that huge economic crisis hit, I think one of the, what was the name of the bank in the UK that was the, one of the first signals that something was...
Northern Rock.
Very interesting example. I'll explain why. What happened was this. Because what happened was that suddenly Northern Rock couldn't get money from other banks. The banks rely upon moving money between themselves. But Stiglitz explains, banking has long been based on trust. If you look at it historically, at their best, that's what banks were. They were, if you like, what he describes as stalwart community institutions that made careful and judicious loans to promising small businesses and prospective home owners. So in 1973, when I bought a flat on the Isle of Wight, my first purchase of a property, I had to borrow money from the bank on the Isle of Wight. And the bank manager made it his business to get to know me. He had to feel that he could trust me. You know, that my income was investigated, all these sorts of things and so on. And finally I was given a loan, and it was very strictly limited to the maximum you could borrow from a bank was 2.5 times your annual salary. So everything was done incredibly carefully. Similarly with small businesses and so on. Everything was done in terms of personal relationships. Bank managers knew people in their locality. Might seem sort of an ideal system, but that's how it largely was. Bank managers, they had respect at that time. Sounds extraordinary now, but people who worked for banks were well respected. So that this is how banks used to work. But what happened is that from the 1990s onwards, you had a huge amount of deregulation of banks, and traditional bankers tended to disappear, and banks aggressively branched out into other activities, and in the process, Stiglitz says, trust went out of the window. And commercial lenders hard sold mortgages to families who couldn't afford them using false assurances. In particular, this is what happened in the United States. They comforted themselves, the bankers, with the idea that no matter how much they exploited their customers and how much risk they were undertaking, they could develop new insurance products, derivatives and other chicanery that insulated their banks from the consequences. So they bundled up all these loans, including very risky loans, which were somehow valued as being incredibly trustworthy bundles or stocks and sold on the stock exchange in Wall Street. And Stiglitz says, if any of them thought about the social implications of their practices, whether it was predatory lending, abusive credit card practices or market manipulation, they took comfort that in accordance with Adam Smith's dictum, that's the invisible hand, their swelling bank accounts implied that they must be boosting social welfare. So they fooled themselves. Let me give you an example. This phrase, I love that phrase, predatory lending. So we think about loan sharks, don't we? The people that they're in the news a lot in the UK and other places, loan sharks. Predatory lending, this is what banks did. It got so extreme, I think this is probably the most extreme example in the United States, in a town called Bakersfield, California, an agricultural worker, a strawberry picker, who had an annual income of $14,000, $14,000, was lent $724,000 to buy a house. It's just quite incredible, isn't it? $14,000 annual income being lent, $724,000 to buy a house. Another example, this is from New York. A maternity nurse and her sister ended up owning 6 townhouses in Queens in New York. How did this happen? Well, she and her sister bought their first house, a townhouse in Queens, New York. When the value of that house rose, you've got to remember that it was like a huge boom in house prices. When the value rose, the lenders came by and visited them and suggested you could refinance and borrow another $250,000 to buy another townhouse. Why don't you do that? So they did. Then the price of that house rose, the same thing happened again, and eventually they owned 6 houses. And when the crash came, of course, they couldn't make the repayments. And they lost everything, including their own home. So this mirage created by bankers cost millions of people in the United States their homes during and after the crisis, and lots of people in this country lost their homes. And what happened was that once the financial crisis started, you had a cascade of destruction of trust. And one of the main reasons why the financial crisis in 2007 and 2008 was so enormous was that no bank could trust another bank. Stiglitz writes about it this way. Each bank knew the shenanigans it had been engaged in. All of the, if not exactly illegal, close to illegal activities. The movement of liabilities off its balance sheets. The predatory and reckless lending. And so each bank knew that it could not trust any other bank. And the result was that the movement of finance between banks, which, if you like, was the oil of the financial system, froze completely. And the financial system came to the verge of collapse, saved by a massive injection of public money, which the people of the United States and the UK and other countries paid for, not paid anyway by the banks themselves. And of course, it's the people's trust that have been the most abused of all. So you have trust, the loss of trust is quite devastating. And there are signs, I think, that similar tendencies are starting to happen again now. What about the effect of inequality of incomes and wealth on empathy? This is another, I think, really interesting and disturbing area. You may remember Daniel Goleman, who wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence. He's written quite a lot about social status and empathy. And he's reviewed recent research. And what he says that recent research shows, and is very clear, is that the richer and more powerful a person is, the less empathy he or she is likely to have for people who are lower in status. So one of the research things was they conducted 5-minute get acquainted sessions with strangers. So they put people, strangers, together for 5 minutes to get to know each other. And the richer and more powerful persons were observed to show fewer signals of paying attention to the other person. They didn't nod or laugh. They were more likely to check their mobile phones. They were more likely to express disinterest and disregard by their facial expressions. They were more likely to take over the conversation and interrupt or look past the other speaker. They displayed less empathy. In another study, a group of social psychologists from the University of Amsterdam and the University of California arranged for pairs of strangers to tell one another about difficulties they had been through. Difficulties might be a divorce or a death of a loved one or whatever. And what they found was the richer and more powerful people were much less compassionate towards the hardships described by the less powerful. Another study, the University of California, found that wealthy people are nowhere near as skilled at reading other people's emotions in comparison to uneducated and poor people. Uneducated and poor people are much better at understanding what's going on for someone, can read other people's emotions. And the conclusion of this study at the University of California was that poorer people often have to rely on others, whereas wealthy people don't ask for help very often. So that wealthy people may be less concerned and less perceptive of other people's needs and wishes. They show a deficit in empathetic accuracy. In other words, they're nowhere near as good in personal empathy as those who are less well off. The co-author of that study was a man called Dasher Keltner of the University of California, and he said, "We are living in a period of historically high inequality, and people in positions of power are not going to see that inequality. They are going to be blind to it, and that has enormous implications for how we educate leaders, why they may not see what's obvious, and why they may not even understand the suffering of the people below them. They are so out of touch, they do not understand suffering." Daniel Goleman, commenting on all this, says, in some way this might explain, in America, the behaviour of Republicans in the United States Congress. So one of the big welfare programmes is known as food stamps, and of course you've had all the issues and promotion and disputes over Obamacare, medical care. And he says, well, you think about it, you know, food stamps are essential for people to live. Obamacare, one of its aims, very simply, is to allow those with pre-existing health conditions to get insurance coverage. At the moment, without Obamacare, they can't get health insurance coverage. And Daniel Goleman comments, this is happening because of this empathy gap. What's happening in the United States is that voting districts are becoming more and more isolated. So a Republican is within a very safe district in terms of it consistently votes Republican. They don't have to encounter many voters from a rival party. They don't have to encounter people from lower incomes, much less empathise with them. They have no idea of what is happening for other people. And he says that the economic gap caused by inequality, of course, causes huge damage. But he says there's a potentially much worse gap caused by the inability to see oneself in a less advantaged person's shoes. You cannot see yourself, if you're rich and powerful, in a less advantaged person's shoes. Just to defend Adam Smith, I was talking about him earlier in his theory of the invisible hand. There are two sides to Adam Smith. Adam Smith wrote about the market and the economy. He also wrote another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is probably one of the best books written on empathy and compassion by a Western philosopher. It's quite sort of contradictory. And he talks in some of his writings about the need to put yourself fully in someone else's shoes. And in my book, The Buddha on Wall Street, I've got a full quote in there from Adam Smith, which is remarkably like, if you like, it's sort of a end of 18th century version of Shantideva's reflecting on exchange of self and other in the Bodhisattva, the way of the Bodhisattva. So just to defend Adam Smith, there is another side to him. And that is being lost in the loss of empathy. And we can add to that, and this is where the democracy side of it comes in, the concentration of power, the loss of democracy that comes with increasing inequality of income and wealth through business lobbying and financing of the political process. In the United States, you see this very clearly. There was a famous court case some years ago called Citizens United, I think it was called, where the Supreme Court said that businesses can finance political campaigns to whatever extent they wish. And that completely distorts the political process now in the United States. So, with the concentration of income and wealth, you get a concentration of power and a loss of democracy. All of this is quite disturbing, I think. What's even more disturbing is that when you read Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, what you realise that what's been happening in the last 30 years is not untypical of the history of capitalism. It's not untypical. The period that I grew up in, I was born in the late 1940s, and I grew up during the 1950s and 60s, and certainly into the 1970s, that was a period of reducing inequality. Strong welfare state, strong trade unions and so on, a period of reducing inequality. When you look at the history of capitalism, it was a blip. It was a blip caused by special factors. The aftermath of war, very strong trade unions, the need for higher taxation to fund lots of things, infrastructure in the country and so on. I took it for granted. That's the way the world is. Of course, since the 1980s, it's been very different. I've been disabused of that belief. And Piketty argues that if left to themselves, the owners of capital will always take to themselves a higher percentage of income. They will appropriate to themselves more and more of the wealth created by economic activity. So the implications of that conclusion are quite bleak. High levels of inequality, low levels of social mobility, the inability of people to progress and make a success of their life will become the norm. So our current economic system is taking us in that direction. Inherited wealth will dominate any other form of wealth accumulated through a lifetime of work, and wealth will concentrate to levels that are incompatible with democracy. It's quite a stunning conclusion, that, isn't it? That Piketty and others are coming to. Wealth will concentrate to levels incompatible with democracy. Certainly the democracy that may be imperfect, though it is, that we've been used to since the Second World War. So what can we learn from Buddhism about inequality and what we might do about it? So in his time, the Buddha saw that governments had a major responsibility in establishing a fairer society. And there's two stories in particular from the early collections of the Buddha's teachings in the Pali Canon that illustrate this point. He used to engage with kings and rulers and advise them on how to rule. And he would tell stories or myths to make his point. So there's a teaching called the Kutadanta Sutta. And the story is told of a king called King Wide Realm, whose land is racked with discontent and crime, such that people are afraid to walk in the streets for fear of violence. And the king goes to a wise man for advice. But the advice the king receives is not what he expects. The wise man tells the king that punishment is not the right path. On the contrary, it would increase the problem because the root causes of the discontent remain untouched. And the root causes in this case are economic injustice and poverty. And the wise man advises King Wide Realm to give food and seed corn to farmers, capital to traders, and food to those in government service, and a variety of other measures. In this way, the king is advised to redistribute income and wealth in his land, in his nation. Well, that's one teaching. In another teaching, the Buddha tells the myth of a wheel-turning monarch. I don't know if you're familiar with this. A wheel-turning monarch, what it is, this is a monarch. And if the rule of the monarch was just, a wheel gem would appear, a symbol would appear, a visible symbol of just rule, a wheel gem would appear. So a monarch whose rule was just, and for whom this wheel gem would appear, was known as a wheel-turning monarch. And there was a wheel-turning monarch who was worried about what might happen to him and to future kings. And he was advised, as long as you look after everybody in your land, in your nation, you prevent crime, you defend people, and you look after the needs of the poor, things will be okay and the wheel gem will always be there. So he does this. And for seven generations after his death, his descendants also do that. And each of them cause the wheel gem to appear. You can't inherit it. You create the wheel gem, the symbol of the wheel gem, by just rule. And then another ruler comes along who does not look after the poor. And that starts a descent into chaos. So you have a neglect of the poor by the king, the wheel gem disappears, and gradually there's a disastrous decline into lawlessness and violence. And the Buddha identified the failure of the king, of the monarch, to look after the needs of the poor as the cause of the decline. And the way that the decline is reversed is a small group of people come together and they live ethically according to the Buddha's precepts and gradually reverse the situation. So in my view, a Buddhist perspective would conclude that governments must ensure a more even distribution of income and wealth. Now, we put this practice at the heart of our sanghas. We talk about the Dharma economy, and if you like, the underlying principle of the Dharma economy is from each according to their ability and to each according to their needs. Quite similar in some ways to the Communist Manifesto, but it was coined, that phrase, something like that, much earlier than the Communist Manifesto. From each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. This means, in businesses run by Triratna, in centres like this, retreat centres and so on, all those who receive financial support to work full time for the centre or for the business are treated equally according to this principle, according to their need, whatever their position within the organisation. So you might have, I remember Pavloka, I lived at Pavloka Retreat Centre for 6 years. So you'd have a chairman of the charity, who was a man, when I was there, a man called Padma Badra, who's still there, who's definitely seen, if you like, as the spiritual leader of the place. The level of support that Padma Badra received then and receives now is no different from, if you like, the junior-most person in that community. It's no different. He's treated exactly the same. It's a very important principle, that having that principle there in our movement is a shining example that there are alternative ways of doing it. Now, it might be, you think, such a radical stance is unlikely to find, at the moment anyway, widespread acceptance outside Buddhist communities. But we shouldn't underestimate its value as a living symbol of what might be achievable. And actually, you know, there are in existence businesses and organisations. They're not totally the same, but they get much closer to the ideal of from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And the major example of this is actually, I was going to call it a major national corporation or organisation. I think it operates in several countries now, so you could legitimately describe it as a major multinational enterprise. And it's called Mondragon, Mondragon. It's one of the largest cooperative enterprises in the world, based in northern Spain. It has lots of different kinds of businesses, ranging from heavy industry, retail industry, to banking and education. It employs altogether in its different organizations 75,000 employees. So they have a series of cooperatives in lots of different businesses. And they have a very important principle. No manager in any of the individual co-ops can make more than 6 times the salary of any worker in that co-op. So the maximum range allowable within a co-op between the highest paid and the lowest paid is a ratio of 6. Not perfect, but a huge difference compared to over 200 times. And it's over 200 times the average level of pay, not the lowest pay. So Mondragon is quite a significant example of what is achievable. And they get high quality managers. You know the argument that's made, we have to pay our managers, you know, this huge sum of money, because if we didn't pay them, they'd go and get the same somewhere else and we'd lose all our talent. Well, for Mondragon, people are prepared to work for them for a lot less because of the whole ethos of the cooperative. I think also, as well as that ratio, They have another rule because there's lots of different cooperative businesses that go up to make this multinational enterprise Mondragon. The difference, I think all of the chief executive officers or managers, head managers of the different co-ops, the pay range across them has to be contained within a band of 38%. So no manager in one of the cooperatives can earn more than 38% more than any other top manager. So they have another constraint that comes in. So they hold income within two quite tight constraints. In terms of distribution of income in a nation, it's interesting what Sangharakshita had to say about this. He said, in society as a whole, there is no doubt that property is inequitably distributed, in the sense of not being distributed in accordance with the genuine needs of people. And for Bhante, for Sangharakshita, this means that in a democratic country, a more equitable distribution of property or wealth must be achieved through legislation. He's in favour of legislation to achieve a more equitable distribution of property or wealth, as well as by the encouragement of a deeper understanding and a more effective practice on the grandest possible scale of the principle of generosity or sharing. So what we do at the level of a Sangha is important. But I think Sangharakshita is saying we need to have a very close eye on what is happening at the level of a nation, even at the level of cross nations internationally, in terms of a more equitable distribution of property or wealth. So if we were to have an eye on that, what could we take a stance on as Buddhists in terms of legislation? Well, we talk about truthful communication. So, in the spirit of truthful communication, we could argue all companies must publish every year figures that show the ratio of the total compensation of their top manager to the median or average compensation of their employees. Very simple thing. What is the truth of the ratio of pay levels between top managers and the average pay of their workers? Seems very simple, doesn't it? But that would be a really radical step forward, apparently. A really radical step forward. So in the United States, for example, there was an act passed through the United States Congress a few years ago which actually stipulated that that must be done. But it still hasn't been done, because businesses are totally opposed to revealing these figures. When it comes to the UK, all right, the European Commission in Brussels proposed that 10,000 of the European Union's top companies listed on stock exchanges should reveal these pay ratios. The 10,000 top companies on European stock exchanges should reveal the ratio of the pay of the top manager to the average pay of their workers, and let shareholders vote on whether these ratios are acceptable or not. That hasn't happened. The biggest howls of anguish came from the business community in the UK. Bitterly opposed within the UK. So, actually getting some clear understanding and openness on that issue would be a big step forward. But there are other things that we could talk about. You may be aware that, was it last year or the year before, that in Switzerland, a young people's organisation organised and got a referendum in Switzerland on what should be the nationally allowed ratio of top pay to average pay in an organisation. And they proposed to restrict the pay gap between the top manager and the average pay in an organisation to a ratio of 12 to 1. That was the proposal in the Swiss referendum. Well, it was rejected. But it's very interesting that 35% of those who voted in the referendum voted in favour of that proposition. 35% of the Swiss population voted in favour of that proposition, of a ratio of 12 to 1. But this is something I think that goes with what people feel is ethically right or what is ethically wrong. So that, why not start to think about what kind of ratio could we campaign around in the UK on that? Now, I mentioned earlier Peter Drucker, this management consultant in the United States in the 1970s, who said that he thought the maximum allowable ratio should be 20 to 1. We had the Swiss talking about 12 to 1. I don't mind what ratio is chosen, but if you have twin aims of complete openness and honesty about these ratios and you pick a figure somewhere between 12 and 20, it's a start. It's a start. It's a basis for an argument and a discussion, a reasonable starting point. So there's something there that we could think about in terms of fairness. A second element is to do with the redistribution of income and wealth through progressive systems of taxation and supportive benefits for the less well off. I mentioned earlier, this is how Sweden redistributes its income, through progressive taxation and a very generous wealth system of welfare state. There's a book that's just came out last month by Professor Atkinson on, I think it's called Inequality, What to Do About It. This is a man who has campaigned around inequality, I think, since the early 1960s. He's an extraordinary man. And his book contains a lot of proposals to deal with inequality, which I think we could... I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but some of the proposals include, for example, much more progressive income tax system so that people at the lower end pay less tax. People at the top end, I think he includes a top rate of 65% or something like that. He talks about a guaranteed job for everyone through the public sector. The public sector has to provide work for everyone and so on. These seem like incredibly radical things. In the 1960s, they weren't. This is what I find extraordinary. People's memory. I grew up in a world where people got worried when unemployment reached 400,000. 400,000. People thought, that's high. People talked about running a society with a level of unemployment of 250,000 in the UK, where you had lots of expectations and so on of a kind of world that you would live in with very progressive systems of taxation and so on. So there are elements, I think, this is my personal view, that as Buddhists we can look at in terms of what we might raise as campaign issues. So, there's another aspect to this, actually, and Professors Wilkinson and Pickett point this out. We want to create a society in which it is possible for people to work on themselves in the direction of loving kindness and generosity and wisdom, and away from greed, hatred and delusion, away from envy and things like this. And Professors Wilkinson and Pickett make the point that if you have a policy of reducing inequality in incomes and wealth, it significantly reduces the pressures for people to go towards consumerism. It significantly reduces the pressures of consumerism. So that, let me try and make the argument. They're right that consumerism stands as a marker of the dysfunctional power of status competition in social relations. And reducing inequality is the key to reducing consumerism. Why? Okay. In more unequal societies, people get pressured to consume more. They work longer hours, get into debt more, they're more likely to go bankrupt. You are pressured into thinking that the gaining of material things is the way to gain well-being. And the more unequal the society is, the greater is the pressure towards consumerism. And reducing inequality reduces the pressure to consume. Very interesting, they say there's a lot of evidence. Lower levels of inequality encourages people to be much more interested in the amount of time they have for leisure and by implication for reflection. The more unequal a society, the more time and people, the more interest people have in time for leisure. I remember in the 60s or early 70s when Britain and America were quite different in the sense that America was, I think, to a large extent, more unequal and more consumer-driven than Britain was. And you may be aware of it then and now. People in America, I think they take, is it 2 weeks holiday a year? 2 weeks holiday a year, maximum. Quite a few of them don't even take that for fear of losing their jobs and being seen as not being hard working enough. And this American professor was writing about why is this? And he was saying that people in the United States are concerned to earn more and more pay and get higher status through pay. Whereas people in the UK, he thought, had it right because there was more interest in the balance of life between how much you earned and how you used your time. And Wilkinson and Pickett argued that the more unequal the society is, the greater the pressures are to consume, to get more money, to survive, to get more consumer products. The more equal the society, the more interest there is in having more time for leisure and reflection. We as Buddhists have a very strong interest in that. When the Buddha was talking with monarchs and kings and rulers about the kind of society they should be running, he was trying to create a structure of society in which it would be possible for more people to move towards enlightenment. In order for that to happen, people need time. People need time to reflect. People need time to stand back. So, reducing inequality helps to reduce the pressure to consume and encourages more interest in leisure rather than in material consumption. There are other things I could mention. I, for a long time, was active in trade unionism. Trade unionism has declined a lot. And okay, there are faults with trade unionism. There were faults and there still are. But actually, when you look back, in America and in Britain, stronger trade unions meant a much more equal distribution of income. We need to think about, and it's interesting that quite a lot of economists now who are concerned about inequality are talking about how can we have legislation that enables people to organise collectively in order to progress their income levels and have their balance of work and life and so on. Collective organisation of some kind or other is very important. There are different models around. It doesn't have to be just the UK model of trade unionism. You have different models in Germany and other countries. So it's worth thinking about that. Collective organisation of people at work does help. I always remember, I think it was in the 1980s in Australia, the Australian equivalent of the Trade Union Congress, in one year, a few years, they made their main campaigning aim was actually they limited the amount of pay increases that all their constituent unions were seeking in order to fund a massive change in the working conditions of teachers. In the working conditions of teachers, because teachers, they realised, were essential and a valuable part of the future of Australia. And I thought that was a classic, very good example of how collective organisation can work for a very worthy social aim. So a collective organisation, I think, is something that we need to be aware of. One final point. I thought I had nothing to say today. I'm really sorry, it's gone on much, much longer than I thought. It's been a more sort of reflective talk. But sometimes, you still hear this, there is a view around that Buddhism does not believe poverty is a hindrance on the spiritual path. That somehow poverty is a noble thing. Not true. The Buddha firmly took the position that a lack of the necessities of life in terms of food and shelter must be rectified first in order for there to be a necessary foundation for spiritual progress to be in place. The Buddhist path is a middle way between asceticism and hedonism, emphasizing that basic material needs must be met before spiritual needs can be dealt with. And this is epitomized by an event once when the Buddha made everyone wait for a teaching until a newly arrived poor man had been fed. He would not allow the teaching to happen until the newly arrived poor man had been fed. And this story is said to be the basis for the Buddha's phrase, "Hunger is the worst disease."